From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with journalist Leslie Coburn. Her new book, Out of Control, is a look at the Reagan administration's covert war in Nicaragua, a subject back in the news with the release of the Iran-Contra Committee's final report. Also today, I speak with Czechoslovakian emigre novelist Jan Novák. His new comic novel, The Grand Life, draws from his own experiences as a mid-level bureaucrat for the phone company. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the new album from lutenist Paul Odette. And Jan Harald Brunvand demonstrates that even the computer world has urban legends. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. The Congressional Committee investigating the Iran-Contra affair has just released its report. My guest is journalist Leslie Coburn. Since 1984, she has investigated U.S. covert operations in Central America. She thinks there are several key issues that were not brought to light by the Iran-Contra hearings. Coburn is a producer for CBS News. Her reports have appeared on 60 Minutes and West 57th. Her work has won a DuPont Award and an Emmy. Leslie Coburn's new book, Out of Control, is about the Reagan administration's covert operations in Nicaragua, the illegal arms pipeline, and the Contra drug connection. I just spoke with her from NPR member station WAMU in Washington, D.C. Before we discussed her reaction to the Iran-Contra report, she described the related stories that she covered for CBS.
Well, for CBS News, we broke the story of Oliver North's network, who was in it, who was running the arms, where the arms were running from out of the United States into Central America, where the Contra training camps were, what Americans were fighting inside of Nicaragua. So that was one of them. Then we proceeded into looking into the drug issue and did two stories on that, two major pieces about drug traffickers who had been solicited by CIA field operatives for cash, pilots, and planes for this operation. So it was essentially arms and drugs, I suppose you could say. We had done stories before about how the actual war in Nicaragua was being fought by the Contras.
Did you volunteer for these stories?
Oh, absolutely.
Why did you want to cover Central America?
Well, I think that it's very important for people to know what is going on whenever we're involved in a war. And I think that's it. It would be the same for me if it were a war in Laos many years ago. I think that these kinds of things should come out into the open.
You've heard the press conference on the final report from the committee, though I know you haven't had a chance to read through the 600 pages of the report yet. But so far, what do you think are the most important conclusions of the committee's report?
Well, I think it was interesting. The committee was quite strong. They were talking about words like secrecy, deception, disdain for law. They admitted that the work that they had done couldn't really be conclusive because of destroyed evidence, contradictory testimony, and the death of Casey. So I think that was all quite straightforward. They were quite hard on Reagan. They said if the president didn't know, he certainly should have known. But I still think that there are many issues in this whole operation that didn't come out in the hearings or indeed in the report.
We'll get to some of those issues in a moment. I'm curious about how you think they handled the president's role in the Iran-Contra affair. On the issue of the president, the committee said whether he knew or not, he failed to fulfill his constitutional mandate to make sure that the laws are faithfully executed. What do you still want to know about the president's role in Iran-Contra?
Well, I thought it was interesting when Chairman Hamilton was asked, even though you don't have the evidence for the president knowing about this, do you think it's believable or possible that he couldn't have known? And he said that he didn't think it was believable that the president didn't know. I mean, I think when you look at the close relationship between Casey and the president, and you look at the news reports that came out as early as June 1986, stating very clearly that top Reagan administration people said that Reagan had given oral approval for this kind of covert operation in Central America. So there is evidence out there that the president certainly did know.
Let's get to what you call some of the black holes in the Iran-Contra hearings. You said that the Iran-Contra hearings never really penetrated the Contra-drug connection. Now, this is a story that you covered for CBS.
That's right.
How did you get onto the story?
Well, we got onto the story because we'd done other pieces on the arms connection. We came out with a big story in June of 1986 saying that Oliver North was running this illegal arms pipeline to Central America. So we got onto it because the arms pipeline was generated out of Miami. It involved people in Washington, in Miami, and Costa Rica. And we stumbled across the drugs being moved at that same time.
So from the information you have, you think there was a drugs for arms deal?
Oh, yes. I think that there are several cases where that happened. You have quite a famous drug trafficker in Miami by the name of George Morales. Morales says that he donated $3 million in cash, gave pilots and planes to the Contras at the bequest of a CIA field agent in Costa Rica by the name of Octaviano Cesar. There are documents showing that these two men did travel to the Bahamas together to pick up at least $400,000. There are other cases like this. There are pilots who say that they took weapons, large amounts of weapons, down to bases in Costa Rica and in Honduras, and that they returned with large quantities of cocaine.
Who are some of the other leading characters in the story?
In the drug story, there's a very important figure called Ramon Millian Rodriguez. He was a famous and very wealthy money launderer for the Medellin cartel in Colombia. He ran an operation out of Panama and in the United States that was running $200 million of cash a month. Now, he says that he was approached by Felix Rodriguez, who was a key player, as you will remember, in North Network, and that Felix Rodriguez asked Millian Rodriguez to contribute large amounts of cash for the Contra effort and to launder large amounts of cash through Miami companies. He has testified about this behind closed doors to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and we're going to hear a lot more about this when they have their hearings.
Do you think that Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North knew about the drug connection?
Well, North certainly knew that drugs were involved in the operation in Central America to a certain extent. Just from the documents we have, we know from his personal calendar that he was concerned that there was one flight moving arms out of New Orleans that he said was probably bringing drugs back into the United States. Robert Owen, who was his courier, was giving him information that some of the followers of the leading commandante on the Southern Front that they were supporting were drug traffickers. So he knew that at least some of this was going on.
Now, you actually found one of the air bases that you think was being used to transport drugs to Miami.
That's right. Apparently there were a number of strips. I've been to a number of the identified drug strips in Costa Rica. One of the major questions is whether an important CIA operative in Costa Rica and very big-time rancher John Hull, who was working with the North Network, allowed drug planes to move through his ranch. He was certainly moving arms through and training Contras there, and this is what some of these people are accusing him of.
You interviewed some of the drug traffickers
Yes.
involved in the story. How did you get them to talk?
Well, it took a long time. You know, you go to these people, and there are many areas that they are frightened of talking about, not only because it might mean that they'll get a longer jail sentence if they're already in jail, or they'll be put in jail if they're not in jail, or they may be killed for doing it. So it's a very touchy area, and it takes, in a number of cases, it's taken months. It took months to get them to talk about it publicly.
Did you have to offer any reassurances to them that if they talked, you would handle their interview sensitively, or did you have to make any agreements with them?
Well, there's nothing really that you can offer to these people, and they're very savvy about this. They know that. I mean, there's nothing we can offer, and they even know that there's very little Congress can offer. One of them came up and testified publicly, George Morales. He testified without immunity. You know, what can you offer a person who lives in that sort of world?
Do you think that the drug connection should have been explored further in the Iran-Contra hearings?
Yeah, I think what was disturbing was that there was a memo issued by the committees on July 23rd of this year, which said that literally hundreds of people had been interviewed on the drug subject, and that there was no evidence that this had ever happened, that it was all quote-unquote street talk. But it turned out that that staffer who wrote that memo had gone to Hayden Gregory, who is chief counsel of the crime subcommittee in the House, who knew a good deal about the drug issue, 2 days before, saying, should we look into it? And Gregory was absolutely furious that they'd issued this memo. I mean, either they interviewed hundreds of people in 2 days, or they're being less than candid.
What are your expectations of the Senate Foreign Relations Subcommittee on Terrorism and Narcotics that will be holding hearings into covert drug operations in November?
Well, I think...
Is it November, by the way? Is it still scheduled
for
November?
No, it's fallen back. It's going to be December now.
Yeah.
That's what they say. One good thing about it is that you've got two strong senators, a liberal senator, John Kerry from Massachusetts, and a very conservative senator, Senator Jesse Helms. These guys are working together on the drug issue. Their investigators are working very hard. They're making numerous trips to Central America and Miami. And I'm hopeful that they'll be coming up with some very interesting hearings, and so are they.
Journalist Leslie Coburn is my guest. Her new book is titled Out of Control, subtitled The Story of the Reagan Administration's Secret War in Nicaragua, the Illegal Arms Pipeline, and the Contra Drug Connection. She's a producer for CBS News, and her reports have been on 60 Minutes and West 57th. What was the reaction of your network when you brought them back this story, saying that there was that there were several drugs for arms deals going on?
Well, remember, we had come back with the story of Ollie North's network some months before that story broke, generally in the press. So they hadn't believed that one, but they put it on the air, and they said, well, I guess if this is true, this could also be true. I mean, the level of disbelief was the same on both stories. You know, they knew who we were talking to. They saw the dozens and dozens of people that we'd been speaking to. They went over the evidence, and they were satisfied with it. So we got a lot of support.
Let's get to another issue that you think wasn't fully investigated in the Iran-Contra, by the Iran-Contra Committee. You think that the CIA wasn't probed deeply enough.
No, I don't. I think that there were people up and down the chain of command, I know there were, in the CIA who were involved in this operation, from the lowest operatives in the field in Costa Rica, of which I can think of three off the bat, to the station chief in Costa Rica, to the task force chief for Central America, Alan Fires, Claire George. There were a large number of people in the CIA who were involved. It was made to seem this summer as though it was only perhaps a kind of a little junta run by Bill Casey that involved a chain of command that went straight to Ollie North. This wasn't the case. Alan Fires was equally important in the day-to-day decision-making of this operation, as was Ollie North.
Why, if you think that the Iran-Contra committee didn't go far enough in their investigation, why do you think they didn't?
Well, from what I hear from my sources in Capitol Hill, is they were reluctant to go into anything that involved, of course, national security. They did talk about these issues behind closed doors, but they were very reluctant to get into any shady operations that might involve CIA assets or proprietaries.
You think that this is information they didn't want public?
I think this is information that they rather... you know, would rather have in testimony behind closed doors, which is precisely what they did.
Now, you point out in your book, Out of Control, that Oliver North was very forthcoming about how there was a fall guy plan set up. But you say that although it looked like everybody came clean on the fall guy system, that in fact there was a fall guy, and it ended up being the conveniently dead William Casey.
Yeah, I think it goes continues from what we were just saying, you know, there's Bill Casey. He's dead. He was supposedly running this operation, and it cuts down the number of people who were involved to a very small group: North, Poindexter, Secord, Hakim, Bill Casey. In fact, you know, you had Elliot Abrams over the State Department, who sat on the restricted interagency group. He was involved. His people were involved. I think that in the end, you know, Casey played the role of the fall guy. He thought it was going to be North, and it turned out to be himself. It produced the kind of things like when in the committee report they said they talked about a cabal of zealots. I think if it was a cabal, it was a very large one. You know, I mean, Oliver North was receiving intelligence information from the Pentagon, for example. There was support from the FBI. There were cover-ups of investigations out of the Justice Department. So it's that's a very large cabal.
I want to get to one more issue that you think wasn't investigated thoroughly by the Iran-Contra Committee, and that is the assassination attempt that was made on Contra leader Eden Pastora's life. And although he didn't die in this bomb assassination attempt, eight people were killed, including one American journalist. And another American journalist, Tony Avragan, who I believe is a friend of yours, was injured in it and has begun, with his wife, another journalist, Martha Honey, they've begun an investigation into this themselves.
Yes, I know both of them. They're very well-known journalists in Central America. They've been investigating this since the beginning of 1985. Actually, I think they started really investigating it just after the bombing in 1984, but it got going in 1985. They are, as you may know, they're bringing suit through the Quistic Institute against a number of people who were involved in North's operations, saying that they had involvement in the assassination attempt on Eden Pastora. It's a very interesting and important investigation because you have people who sat in on meetings where the possible assassination of Pastora was discussed. You have people inside the Costa Rican government who were in the intelligence service who say, yes, that they saw meetings between the supposed assassin and John Hall, who was the rancher, who was the CIA operative at the time. There was a meeting that night, the night of the assassination attempt in San Jose, where the CIA station chief was meeting with Mr. Hall and Robert Owen, who had, of course, was working with Oliver North. There's a great deal of information that should come out on that. I mean, Pastora was at the time a very much a black sheep Contra leader. The CIA was very angry with him and was threatening to pull their funding for his operation because he wouldn't join forces with the FDN and the other larger Contra faction in the North.
I guess this assassination attempt on Eden Pastora's life was especially upsetting for you as a journalist, knowing that a fellow journalist was murdered, another was killed.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that that's always the thing a journalist worries about in Central America is when are you going to step on a claymore mine or, you know, get mixed up in the middle of a bombing assassination attempt. So, sure.
I'd like to talk with you more about what the process has been like for you to investigate covert operations in Central America. But first, we're going to take a short break. My guest is Leslie Coburn. She's a journalist with CBS News, and she's been investigating U.S. covert operations in Central America since 1984. Her new book is titled Out of Control, the story of the Reagan administration's secret war in Nicaragua. We'll talk some more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Journalist Leslie Coburn is my guest. Her new book is titled Out of Control. When you first started investigating the Oliver North connection in Central America, and you were bringing this information back to your network, was the reaction there that the story was just too amazing to be believed?
Yes, they did think it was pretty amazing and really didn't believe it at the beginning because, of course, the first shreds of evidence were things like two mercenaries who were in jail in Costa Rica who were talking about an NSC operation they were part of, that $10,000 a month was coming down to supply two Contra camps where they had been training Contras, this kind of thing. So the question was, how can we believe these guys? Aren't they in jail? The thing that made us pursue it and keep going was the amount of detail of information about arms shipments coming out of Miami, tremendous detail. And it was clear that these people were telling the truth.
I guess stories like this always smack of conspiracy theory, and that's the easiest thing to disbelieve.
Well, I think that it was a great shame because these two particular mercenaries, both, well, one is now dead, the other has just gotten out of jail in Costa Rica, they were very forthcoming in the summer of 1985. They saw many journalists, and most journalists didn't believe them at all. I had the advantage of having been tipped off by a special forces operator that there was an operation, a black or covert operation, going on along the southern front border, along the border of Costa Rica and Nicaragua. So I had, I was better able to accept their information.
What did you have to do to prove that your sources were reliable and that there were other sources willing to back up the sources who spoke to you?
Well, it meant an awful lot of plane trips, I think, is the answer. There were other sources in Miami who backed up what these two in Costa Rica were saying. By January of 1986, Senator Kerry on the Hill had started his own investigation of this. There was a very zealous public defender in Miami who was looking into it himself, John Mattis. And I think that all of these bits and pieces came together. What's interesting now is that, you know, we knew that there had been an investigation out of the U.S. Attorney's Office in Miami into this particular operation. And now the assistant U.S. attorney who was looking into that has come out and confirmed that that his investigation was slowed down. He was told to sit on it, quote, sit on it, it's political. There's even a case of a doctored memo. He wanted to indict several people who were working with this network for Neutrality Act violations. A memo that he had written advising that they should be indicted was sent to Washington. It had been doctored, saying this is not the time to do this. This would just be a fishing expedition. This is very serious, because that was used as evidence to stop a Senate investigation at the time.
Do you know if there was ever any administration pressure put on the network to either kill or tone down your stories?
Oh, I think, you know, there are attempts every once in a while, but they're generally these days not too successful, not that I've seen. And that is an honest assessment.
How do people give you cues that they're ready to talk, that they're ready to spill the beans about their involvement in covert operations?
Well, it's usually after you have been talking to them, visiting them for some time. It's usually after about five or six meetings or many, many long phone conversations. And they finally say, okay, let's do it. I'm ready to talk.
You were reporting in Central America. And without being too stereotypic, I should say that there is a certain macho ethic in some of those countries. And you were a woman reporter from North America. Did that work to your advantage or disadvantage at any points during your investigation?
I don't think it really mattered that much. You have to remember that I wasn't all by myself. I was on certain occasions, but mostly I was traveling. There were two women. I was with Jane Wallace, a CBS correspondent. We traveled with a crew who are Miami Cubans, men, both men. I think that the whole issue of, you know, the idea of one woman sort of traveling around Central America never came really into play here.
So you don't think it worked for you or against you in any way?
I don't think it's any different there than anywhere else. I mean, if someone wants to sit down with you because they think you're a pretty woman, then that's fine. Or if they avoid you because they think you're a woman and you're probably a lightweight. I think in Central America, American journalists are taken very seriously, whether they're male or female.
Journalist Leslie Coburn is my guest. How would you compare Iran-Contra to Watergate?
Well, my feeling is that the kinds of laws that were broken during Iran-Contra are much worse than Watergate. You have Neutrality Act violations, Arms Export Act. You have possible attempted assassinations here. You have obstruction of justice, criminal conspiracy, obstruction of Congress. You know, there are a lot of laws that I believe were broken, and I think that Judge Walsh will be looking at these very carefully.
Do you think that there will be indictments?
Yes, I do. I know that he has sent out some target letters, which means that at least four to Ollie North, to Richard Secord, to Albert Hakim, and to Poindexter as well. I think that may well be just the first wave, and it's likely, as of course has been reported, that those people will be indicted.
One of the conclusions of the Iran-Contra Committee's report is that really what we need isn't more laws, it's officials that obey the existing laws. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. You know, I was glad to hear that, because changing a law so that you would have to inform the Intelligence Oversight Committee a little faster, this kind of change isn't going to make any difference, because there were stringent laws in place, and clearly these people didn't care much for these laws. And so there's nothing you can do by writing a new one. You just have to get people to obey them.
When the Iran-Contra scandal broke, did you feel almost, let off the hook in the way, exonerated? Because here was a story that people thought was a little bit fishy, a little bit odd, that you were covering. And suddenly there's the big national story broke, and it became just very public that there was a lot of mischief going on. Did that almost help you as a journalist, if you know what I mean?
Well, I was amazed when it broke. I was shocked. I didn't think that it would break nearly so fast. And I think that for the few journalists, and there were a group of them who had been working on for this some time, everyone was delighted that finally there were going to be hearings, that finally every other journalist was going to look into it as well, because, of course, that opens up all kinds of investigations into different areas of this. And but it was a tremendous shock, I must say. I thought that it was going to be kept covert for a good deal longer. I thought that the kinds of reports that we'd been doing would have gotten lost in the shuffle.
Now, it was a foreign paper, wasn't it, that actually first broke the story of the arms for hostages deal?
Yes, it was. It was a Lebanese paper, and interestingly enough, they broke it because there'd been thousands of leaflets spread out all over Tehran talking about the operation. That's how they came to know about it.
Now, why do you think that the story ended up being broken by a Lebanese paper and not picked up from by the American press coverage?
Well, that's hard to say, because I wasn't really looking into the Iran part of it at that time. I think it may be because a lot of the sources that journalists have here in Washington were leading them in another direction. I know that administration officials kept talking to me about Saudi money, not money from Iran. So it may be a case of people just being misled. The other thing is that, you know, if you want to know what's going on in the Middle East, the best place to be is in the Middle East. So it is surprising that it wasn't picked up by an American journalist somewhere in the Middle East.
Will you continue to cover the story in Central America?
Yes, absolutely. I think that there are a lot of unanswered questions, and I intend to keep covering it.
So what are you looking at now?
Well, right now I'm doing stories for both CBS and PBS Frontline, and I'm working on an hour now, which continues the investigation of this whole subject for PBS as a reporter.
Leslie Coburn, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Leslie Coburn is a reporter for CBS News. Her reports have appeared on 60 Minutes and West 57th. Her new book is titled Out of Control, The Story of the Reagan Administration's Secret War in Nicaragua, The Illegal Arms Pipeline, and the Contra Drug Connection. It's just been published by the Atlantic Monthly Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Mexican novelist Carlos Fuentes, so I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, author Jan Novak explains how eavesdropping in the office helped him write his latest comic novel, The Grand Life. Novak alternates writing with a job at the Chicago Phone Company. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the new album from Paul Odette, today's leading practitioner of Elizabethan lute music. And Jan Harald Brunvand has another urban legend, this one from the world of computers. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. The official Iran-Contra report from Congress was released today. It places the blame for the scandal on the White House, accusing President Reagan of ultimate responsibility for the affair. The 690-page report does not resolve the question of whether the president knew about the diversion of profits from the secret arms sales to Iran, but the report said if the president did not know, he should have. The testimony that proved to be the final word on the president's knowledge was delivered by former National Security Advisor John Poindexter. Today, the chairman of the House Iran-Contra Committee, Lee Hamilton, said the committee had no choice but to accept Admiral Poindexter's statements.
Admiral Poindexter saw the president every day. His office was a few steps away from the president's office. He had, after all, good news for the president, which was that the Contras were being supported. Nonetheless, in my judgment, I accept Admiral Poindexter's word.
The chairman of the Senate committee, Daniel Inouye of Hawaii, said the committee would not recommend big changes to protect against future Iran-Contra affairs. The reason Inouye said is because the fault lies with people, not the system.
The Iran-Contra affair resulted not from deficiencies in our system, but from deficiencies in those who governed. Our modest recommendations illustrate a central proposition of our investigation, and that is, we do not need major new laws. We need government officials to respect the laws we already have.
The White House responded to the Iran-Contra Committee's report, saying that it reflects subjective opinions and is not even the unanimous judgment of the committee. Officials did, however, confirm that former National Security Advisor William Clark wrote the president last summer to urge that he grant pardons to Admiral Poindexter and Colonel North. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The White House received the letter from Judge Clark, a longtime advisor to the president, in August. White House counsel A.B. Culverhouse wrote back, quote, "We are not discussing pardons, period." White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said that as far as he knows, the president never responded in any fashion to Clark's proposal. But Fitzwater refused to rule out the possibility of presidential pardons for officials indicted as a result of the Iran-Contra affair. And he said the issue of pardons, quote, "isn't even suitable for discussion." President Reagan did not respond publicly to the committee report today, but Fitzwater said the report shows the president did not know of the diversion of funds from the Iranian arms sales to the Nicaraguan rebels. Restating the changes in White House policy instituted since last February's report of the Tower Board, Fitzwater said the president violated no laws. The White House said Fitzwater is moving on, and in his words, "we trust that out of this experience has come a new wisdom about the process of governing in America." I'm Brian Naylor at the White House.
Housing construction dropped 8.2% in October, the biggest decline in more than 3 years. Mark Obrinsky of the U.S. League of Savings Institutions says the stock market collapse is not to blame.
My feeling is that although there is probably a strong tendency to want to blame today's numbers on the stock market crash, nonetheless, that probably had relatively little impact. Keep in mind that builders had only about 10 days to react to that out of the 31 in October.
Obrinsky says the decline in housing starts was caused by a steep jump in mortgage rates. Stock prices were higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose nearly 17 points to 1939.16. Advances led declines 2-1 on volume of 158 million shares. The average price of a share on the New York Exchange gained 31 cents. This is NPR News. I'm Mara Liasson in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of a new album of English lute music performed by Paul Odet. He's an American playing an instrument with a long and colorful European history, and he's one of the young superstars of the early instrument movement.
Paul Odet was born 33 years ago in one of the world's most unromantic cities, Pittsburgh. But he's become a master of one of the most romantic of instruments, the lute. He's probably the best lutenist to come along since Julian Bream. His fingers dance over the strings as lightly as he wears his vast scholarship. He's a winning, unpretentious performer who came to lute music by way of guitar, both classical and rock. He actually taught himself to play the lute from 16th century treatises. Lute music has always had a kind of mystique, though for the non-specialist it also has several built-in limitations. The instrument itself is relatively narrow in its range of dynamics and colors, and although it flourished for nearly two centuries, it didn't, perhaps couldn't, produce any large-scale works. Its intimate quietude, of course, is the source of its romance, and the period it most calls to mind remains one of the most intriguing. In Tudor and Jacobean England, the lute was by far the most popular instrument. In the liner notes to his new album, Odet informs us that of the surviving solo works from this period, lute pieces, quote, nearly double the combined repertoire of madrigals and virginal music. That's a lot of lute. One source of the lute's popularity is that it's not a particularly difficult instrument to master. Like the guitar today, it was popular among both professionals and amateurs. It was even the instrument of royalty. Henry VIII, Anne Boleyn, young Edward VI, Queen Mary, and Queen Elizabeth herself were apparently all accomplished lutenists. Odet organizes his recording around this principle. Simple but charming settings of popular Elizabethan songs alternate with technically difficult bravura pieces, often variations on those very songs. Here, for example, is the inevitable but irresistible Greensleeves by the famous Elizabethan composer Anonymous, immediately followed by the more complex arrangement attributed to Francis Cutting.
Thank you.
Not everything on this Paul Odette Lute album is of equal interest. And if you're not in the right mood, listening to nearly an hour of it straight through can turn the music into so much Elizabethan wallpaper. But there are rewards, too. And some of the slower or longer pieces, like The Haunting Fantasy by Gregory Hewitt of Antwerp, and the exquisite title cut of the album, Thomas Robinson's Robin is to the Greenwood Gone, are worth the price of admission. A little historical quibble, though. Since Daniel Bachelard's Mount Sears Almain, the longest work on the album, was composed in 1610, and the arrangements of Scottish dances and folk tunes were collected in 1620, the subtitle of the album, Elizabethan Lute Music, isn't strictly accurate. Good Queen Bess died in 1601.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix, and he teaches at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. He reviewed Paul Odette's new album, Robin is to the Greenwood Gone, on the Nonesuch label. This is Fresh Air. George Clifton ran a data processing office of a large utility company in Chicago, where he got hired fresh out of the Navy as a customer representative. He knew he had a job for life. He took the homicidal public on the chin for 11 years, ate his pile of aspirin, and the company rewarded him by kicking him upstairs. That's the opening of Jan Novak's new comic novel, The Grand Life. Novak understands life in the bureaucracy because he lives it. He makes his living as a computer operations supervisor for the telephone company in Chicago. But his main character, George, the most status quo bureaucrat of all, eventually breaks out of his routines and begins to indulge in excess. Novelist Jan Novak emigrated from Czechoslovakia with his family when he was a teenager. He's lived in Chicago for the past 17 years. He told me why he wanted to write about office workers.
What I wanted to do with the book was to sort of get down the corporate office life that I live. Of course, it's not a hugely tragic situation, so the only attitude to assume to this material that I've found apt was sort of a satirical attitude. I was, more than anything, what inspired me was the language used in these situations. It's sort of a computer bureaucratic lingo vernacular that's pretty strikingly inadequate to some modes of discourse, you know, talking about feelings or thoughts. But it has to do, and as a result, people use it to talk about these things, and often it results in sort of a skewed poetry.
I think in a way, for someone who's new to a country, that it's the idioms and the slang expressions that make the least sense, because if you translate them literally, they don't mean what they're right. supposed to. Like, he had a beef with his boss. Well, if you know beef as a slab of meat, this expression isn't going to make any sense to you.
That's true, and it didn't at first, you know, but I've been here half my life now. And although I have an accent, I've been absorbing English for 17 years now.
When you started your office job, did you know corporate speak and bureaucratic language?
Not at all. I stumbled into it. I was hired... After knocking about, I had like six jobs within half a year, and I was looking for a job which would allow me to write. I knew I wanted to write then. And this friend told me about a job in the phone company where a full-time job consisted of going to work three times for 12-hour shifts, and then having 3 days off, and at the end of four cycles like this, having 9 days off. So you wind up going to work 12 times a month, and it's a full-time job, ideal for writing. So I went after the job, and I stumbled into this corporate situation, and I've held on to the job since then. I've been able to write that way.
Do your colleagues know that you have a double life, that you're also a writer?
Yeah, yeah. As a matter of fact, I have used... The book is a huge hit around the office because I've used real names of people.
Oh, no,
that I work
really?
With. Yeah.
That's very unconventional.
I thought, you know, I like real names, real sounding names. I hate contrived names. So I thought, well, why not use the people around me? Nobody really matches the character, and they all had to, and the publisher was very nervous about it, so they had to sign releases that they won't sue.
Does your interest in the bureaucratic mind go back to Czechoslovakia and to a political bureaucracy?
In a way, probably that's where it's coming from. Although the bureaucracy in Czechoslovakia is much more maddening than it is here. But it's something that is very present in a Czech life, I would say. And so I've been listening to my parents or people talk about that world in sort of Gogolian satirical terms all my life. And I think that's one of the things that found its way into the book, too.
Did you have to fight through the bureaucracy in order to emigrate?
Well, ours was a very special case, actually. My father had been embezzling some money, and we were escaping before it was discovered. So I think he just bought the passports. We went for a four-day trip to Vienna. It was in the summer. I left in my shorts, and I didn't have a pair of pants for like a month. So we wound up in a refugee camp.
You know, when you were describing how your father had embezzled money and that's why you had to get out of the country, you were laughing. You seemed to find that kind of funny. It didn't sound like you were, embarrassed or ashamed by it.
Well, you know, it happened. I don't see any reason to hide it or anything. It became a sort of an inspiration for my first book. It's a story of a man who embezzles a lot of money and becomes an immigrant and gambles all the money away and comes to this country and succumbs to gambling. And it was, in a way, amusing. Nobody got hurt. You know, all the money's underwritten by the state, and it was only the state that sort of lost out on the embezzlement. And my father thought that since the state took away all the opportunities to sort of reach any kind of a human potential for him, he might as well fight back.
How did your family end up in Chicago? Did you have your eyes set on getting to Chicago when you left Czechoslovakia?
Oh, no, we had our eyes set, I guess. Well, nobody knew about all this, so my father had his eyes set on leaving the country, and nobody else knew we were leaving.
That's true, right.
And then in the refugee camps, we had to decide where to go next. And you could go to... we wound up staying in the refugee camps for almost a year, and they were pretty rough. It's nothing like both people have to face, but it was not very pleasant. So there was a powerful incentive in trying to get out of there. And you could go to South Africa. If you signed up for South Africa, they got you out in a day. If you went to Australia, they got you out in a couple months. Or you could try to go to America, which was probably the easiest country to start out in economically, although there was no assistance.
Do you think, in a way, it was a lucky break that you ended up in Chicago because there are so many interesting speech styles in major American cities? You have all this street language and different dialects, different slang expressions.
Very much so, very much. The Chicago English is definitely a tool of communication that has been impacted greatly by the immigration process. It's been sort of boiled down to, we can communicate anything in Chicago, I think, with using maybe 5,000 words. And there's a certain wonderful punchy quality to it.
That's interesting. So it's a style of speaking that was shaped by the immigrant experience.
To a large degree, right.
When did you feel like you were comfortable writing in English? How long did it take till you got to that point?
It's a very gradual process. I mean, I wrote a screenplay in English while I was still writing in Czech. And I decided to write a novel, and I at first I was still writing in Czech, and I was looking at the, this thing, and I anticipated, you know, 300 pages or something, 400 pages. And I thought of the pain of translation that would be involved in working on it, and I just decided to write it in English. At that point, it was a sort of a conscious decision that it was just too much of a bother to try to translate it. As a matter of fact, I'm going, the book has later, this last year, been translated back into Czech to be also published by the same publishing house in Toronto. And, you know, like I said, at one time I was poised to write the book in Czech, and now I'm reading it in Czech, and it's my book. It's the same sort of driving rhythm, same long sentences, my words. All the episodes are the same. And the language is totally different from anything that I would write. And it's very legitimate. So it's a very distorted view of myself that I get through these pages when I go. That's a eerie, fascinating process.
What makes this especially interesting is that you have all these English colloquialisms that now have to find Czech equivalents in order to get translated into Czechoslovakian.
Well, with Grand Life, it will be a real problem because a lot of the words from the computer vernacular do not have equivalents in Czechoslovakia because basically the technology is not there yet.
So how long are you going to stay in your office job?
I don't know. As long as I have these hours, I think, no matter what else happens in my life.
It gives you security so that you can go home and write.
Right, and it's my umbilical cord to the real world too. You know, I want to know how people don't sleep nights trying to compose their answer to a boss over something. It just gives me a lot of material to write about. It gives me a lot of. It's very linguistically interesting. Just the role of an observer turns me on. And it's provided by this job, so it's not just the economic security.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
I thank you.
Jan Novak's new novel, The Grand Life, is published by Simon & Schuster. He spoke to us from the NPR Bureau in Chicago. You're listening to Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel co-hosts the program, and he's joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Jerry.
Well, the Iran-Contra Committee released its report. How are you covering it?
Well, we'll have a number of reports. Linda Wertheimer, for one, Jim Angle, about how it's going over at the White House, some news analysis from Dan Schur. The report says the administration was guilty of disdain and disregard for the law. For those people who think this whole story has kind of fizzled out, it hasn't ended dramatically enough, we've asked our novelist critic friend Alan Chews to supply us with some alternate plots, as fine novelists might write it up.
What else are you following?
We have a story about political violence in South Africa and that Iranian nuclear plant and why it doesn't seem to be a danger like Chernobyl that it was hit by Iraqi warplanes.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our expert on urban legends, Jan Harald Brundvand, recently attended the annual meeting of the American Folklore Society in Albuquerque. Several papers presented there were about high-tech pranks.
Computers and computer problems have become part of our lives, and a growing body of folklore concerns things that computers have supposedly done to people. Besides the first-hand stories of bank computers lousing up our accounts or airline computers canceling our reservations, there are more elaborate stories that have sprung up, such as the descriptions of mystery glitches, annoying pranks that one person supposedly programs into someone else's computer. These stories often circulate among members of the subculture of computer specialists called hackers. A mystery glitch interrupts the victim's work, issues a demand, threat, or punishment, and then disappears. It embodies that great fear of all computer users, losing data. These stories are true urban legends because they are passed on in different variations, mostly by friends of friends, and seldom by anyone who has been a witness or a victim. Mystery glitches are supposed to be impossible to bypass or to remove from a system, which is highly unlikely. Some such glitches do in fact exist, but they've entered oral tradition far out of proportion to their actual occurrence. Different mystery glitches have been given a variety of names. One is the Trojan Horse, a program that appears to be user-friendly, but which in reality is secretly destroying data. Another frequently told variation is the phantom strikes. The unique feature of this glitch is that it pops out of nowhere, destroys some data, flashes a teasing statement like, "Catch me if you can," and then disappears. Then there's the 5-yard penalty, a glitch that links a message on the screen to the computer's printer. The message reads, "You have just been penalized 5 yards," and then your printer kicks in and spits out 5 yards of blank paper. One of the more frightening mystery glitches is known as the virus. In one version, the computer dials random telephone numbers until it reaches another computer's data tone. Then the program transmits a copy of itself to the second computer, signs off, and resumes dialing. The infected computer begins dialing for hookups, and supposedly the virus spreads until it takes over the entire phone system. The true hacker classic, as it has been called, is Cookie Monster, a mystery glitch for which different people claim authorship. Cookie Monster demands, "Want cookie, gimme cookie," or "Me want cookie." The operator should respond by typing in the word cookie. If an operator tries other keystrokes in an effort to escape, the monster may say, "Don't do that, monster not like that." Eventually, if the monster is not fed, it erases your work and disappears. One programmer told me that the original version of the prank was titled Cookie Bear, but it was, and I quote, "parameterized in such a way that at assembly time you could vary what it called itself and what it begged for." In plain English, this means that the programmer was able to insert any kind of character saying different things. My informant knew of one variation that had Richard Nixon on the screen demanding, "Want pardon." Some hackers delight in giving the monster extra lines in the dialogue, such as, "Thank you, yum, yum, yum." I've seen computer programs with such dialogue inserted in between commands. But just because such programs can be created and printed doesn't necessarily mean that they could also be hidden in another person's computer as a mystery glitch. What these printouts reveal is that much of the technical language used by hackers is so dry that it is understandable why they feel a need to relax at their work now and then and create folklore.
Jan Harald Brunvand is professor of English and folklore at the University of Utah. Write us at Fresh Air with urban legends you've heard, and we'll pass them on to him. Our address is Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. That's Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. Here's a look at tomorrow's Fresh Air. Tomorrow I'll speak with former New York Times columnist William Geist. Geist documented the quirky and chaotic aspects of New York life in his column About New York. His new book, City Slickers, is a collection of those columns. Rock reviewer Ken Tucker will tell us why he likes Stevie Wonder's new album so much. It's Wonder's first album in 3 years. And Stephen Schiff will review Nuts, the new film starring Barbara Streisand and Richard Dreyfuss. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
And we'd like to welcome a station new to Fresh Air, KPBS-FM in sunny San Diego, California. Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.